Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everyone. Quick little housekeeping before we get into the episode today. The first thing is, if you haven't joined us over on Substack, we have some awesome bonus episodes. We do 1 to 2 bonus episodes a week over there. This week, Sam had Mormon missionaries visit her house, and we talk about the process of all of that. We have an episode about cringe culture. Sam does pep talks. We talk about our reaction to people pushing back on us talking about the let them theory. It's a great time over there, and we would love to see you. Right now, we are also running a special on our Substack, so you can get our yearly Substack subscription for 45% off if you use the link below. The other thing I wanted to warn you of is this episode is going to talk about trauma. So there is a content warning for if you're not in the best mental health space, maybe skip this episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Nuance Needed podcast. I'm Amanda White.
And this is Sam Dalton.
And we are going to attempt today to talk about trauma in a very nuanced way.
This is very big. And so we are all holding hands together as we navigate this topic, because I think it's broad. There's breadth and depth to this topic. Mm-hmm. And it's part of why it's taken us so long to decide to talk to you about it.
Yeah, I think this was like one of the first things that we were like, we need to talk about this. And Sam and I have a list, and the list of topics grows whenever you guys give us a suggestion or we come up with an idea. But we have this joke where a lot of times when I open the list, we get so overwhelmed by the list, it like erases our brains. And then we're like, well, we can't do anything on the list. So we have to come up with an entirely new topic and not any of these 45 things.
Yeah, because – and this is the problem sometimes with nuances. You start thinking about it so much.
Breaks your brain.
Yeah, we get a lot of headaches figuring out what to talk to you guys about, but we're in it. And we decided there's no better time like the present.
By the time this comes out, there may be another horrible thing that's happened that makes us be like, this was the wrong episode to put out. So I don't know.
We don't know. And with that, we also just kind of said off mic, because we kind of debated back and forth if we want to talk about this today. And the thing we came to is like, well, there's never going to be a convenient time, probably in the next like 3 years, to have this conversation. So we're just going to do it. And we hope that we've had enough episodes now and you guys trust us enough to know that we're going to do our best to get through this. And we will try to be as compassionate and open-minded as we can while also speaking some truth to power.
Do you want to start? Should I start? Sometimes you're better at starting because you're good at starting broad, where I just will like fall down the rabbit hole. And then I'm like, what? Where? And then you have to back up and be like, no, Amanda, we're going to talk. Let's zoom out for a moment and pick you out of the hole. So I think it's better for you to start.
Nobody give Amanda a shovel. She'll dig.
Put that on my headstone. And now she's there.
Yeah. She dug through to China, everybody. She went right through the molten core and came out the other side. All right. Trauma. It's a big word. And I think what makes it complicated is it evokes so many different feelings and thoughts and experiences and levels of understanding depending upon who you speak about it with. Trauma is an umbrella that PTSD falls under. Mm-hmm. So trauma and PTSD are not synonymous. I kind of want to start there.
Very good place.
People assume those two things are interchangeable. If I'm talking about trauma, I'm talking about my post-traumatic stress disorder. Not everybody who experiences something traumatic will develop post-traumatic stress disorder. post-traumatic stress disorder, I looked this up in advance of knowing we were doing this episode, actually only happens in 6% of individuals total, according to the National Institute of Health. I thought that that was a really good kind of high-level entry point for us to get this out in the open, that simply because you experience trauma does not mean you are going to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. Events can be traumatic, and you can be impacted by those events without needing a formal diagnosis or saying, I have now developed depression as a result of going through this, or I have developed generalized anxiety by going through this. Those things can be separate. So you can experience trauma and not have PTSD. But in order to have PTSD, you would have had to be exposed to or experience some type of traumatic event. Yes. Now, I'm sure you listening to this are like, well, what the hell is a traumatic event? This also gets complicated because, and now you see why we just like slip down these rabbit holes and why Amanda's like, give me more shovels. There's what we kind of like lovingly refer to as like big T trauma, little T trauma. Now, keep in mind with the lists that I am about to throw out are not meant to in any way minimize or diminish anything that you have been through personally, or to say that that could not possibly have been something that gave you PTSD, or that shouldn't have done this, or that could have done that, right? No. We are giving kind of like a high level introduction to what these different things look like. So capital T trauma or big T trauma, that would be someone who's been exposed to combat, mass shooting event, sexual assault, neglect, abuse. There's literally an assessment called ACEs. That's the Adverse Childhood Events Survey. And so it's basically just a list of like the worst possible things that a kid could endure. The death of a parent is on there, chronic illness of a parent, the child experienced chronic illness or acute illness, right? Abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, trauma.
Divorce is on there too.
Yeah, divorce is on there too. And so for certain clients, depending on how they report their childhood, you can go through that survey with them. And the amount of points they have is indicative of the amount of trauma that they've been exposed to. And then there's like levels of how that would impact you, and how people typically respond dependent on where they score. So that is like a very clinical interpretation of trauma and what we as clinicians would look for in assessing someone who comes to us and says, I experienced A, B, C, D, E. This is how I've been impacted. And then we can kind of use that as a frame of reference to move forward. Now, when we're talking about little T trauma, it gets dicey because this is where it starts to become more open to interpretation, and where some people could say, well, I went through that and that didn't affect me. Or, well, I went through that and it destroyed me. This really could also be anything. To use a personal example, my brother, who is disabled, I would say growing up, I experienced traumatic events as a result of that. I did not develop post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of that. And I've even, like, in my own personal work, I've debated, like, would I consider this a big T or a little T? Like, to kind of help myself conceptualize it. And I think living in a home with a sibling or a parent who has a disability, that is something that is going to be so personal. And I would never pretend to tell somebody that that should be a big T or a little T. For me, I would say growing up in the home was at large a big T. And I experienced little T traumas within that big T experience, because it was chronic and prolonged.
And that is the hard thing that I was going to say about PTSD, is that it is diagnosed in a very finite way. It is a certain amount of weeks after it, because there is a diagnosis of acute stress disorder. And it is acute stress disorder for 3 days to 1 month. Once it goes over 1 month, then it is PTSD. This is where it gets really messy. Of little T trauma is more messy. When you have PTSD that is chronic and continues and there is more trauma, that's where we can start to talk about complex PTSD, other mental health conditions that can develop as a result of it. And that is what makes it so messy. It's very clear when someone is in a car accident and then they survive and then they recover and then they deal with the aftermath. They may be afraid of cars. There's work they can do around that. It is much messier when you are constantly being bombarded. And that is sort of where the idea of death by a thousand cuts comes in and is real.
Mm-hmm. There's a world where your interpretation of the event that you survive or go through is kind of what we would base our professional response on, right? So like, if I am never going to say to someone, well, you didn't respond to that correctly. That should have been more traumatic, or that should have been less traumatic. I might help give people language to something when they say like, yeah, like that just, it's weighing on me and it's so heavy and this messed me up and I feel like I'm having these experiences. Then I would say like, yeah, like that was a traumatic event for you. Mm-hmm. That also isn't an indicator that I am now going to say you now have post-traumatic stress.
Right.
Right. So we're constantly, on a professional level, we're constantly walking this fine line of helping people understand that it doesn't have to be all of it at the same time. And I think with TikTok therapy and Instagram therapy and mental health speak and therapy speak, that has been lost. And I think there's a lot of people that I think they get easily overwhelmed when they see some of this content saying like, well, if you went through this, you most likely have PTSD, or this is what PTSD is and this is how it fits. And again, for some people, that's probably very helpful. But I also think for a lot of people, again, like you could have nightmares after experiencing something. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean you need a formal diagnosis. That means your brain is trying to make sense of the experience and is processing it after the fact. You can be upset about something for even a couple of weeks. But if that upset, quote unquote, gets a little bit less and less with each passing week, I am no longer concerned that we're dealing with something that could evolve into post-traumatic stress. We're talking about something that was upsetting and stressful to your nervous system, and your nervous system has been trying to regulate since. A couple of years ago, I got in a really bad car accident where I was T-boned on the driver's side, and I was the driver. And I got very lucky to be like physically fine. And I knew that is something that can really like mess you up psychologically because it was so stressful and it was so overwhelming. Literally 5 hours after the accident, I got in a car and I drove again. And I like forced myself into kind of that exposure therapy to make sure that I didn't develop a fear as a result of the trauma, right? Mm-hmm. So now I don't even say, because of that, I now don't even classify that car accident as like, oh, that was a traumatic event. I just say like, it was stressful and it was terrifying.
Well, to make this even more complicated, a lot of what will make someone's interpretation of this small t really impacted me, this small t didn't, is your current state of mental health, how good your current coping skills are, how much you are able to give yourself space to process it. And also the other really huge thing is the support that you have. And a lot of times there's this equation. It's kind of like hard times with support will create resilience, where the equation of hard times with no support will often create trauma. So a lot of it is your environment, how you respond, how people around you respond. Like I had a very, very traumatic birth and I didn't develop PTSD. I did have, you know, I probably developed more anxiety, depression symptoms and things like that as a result. And I had some more intrusive thoughts, but I had a lot of support. I was also very prepared for this because I knew that postpartum was like a little bit of a risky time for my mental health. I got right into therapy and started doing EMDR, but it still really impacted me. And it took me, it's been 2 years now. Like her first birthday was really hard. It's taken me, I would say, like a good 2 years to really feel more baseline. Mm-hmm. And part of what's so weird with trauma too is it is sort of this, and you alluded to this, Sam, with driving, is it's like when your last experience of something involves trauma, it is really hard because that is what your brain is going to reference. And it gets easier to work through if you're doing things to take care of yourself with support and you also have more time. So, right, time doesn't like solve all these wounds, but time plus taking care of yourself and getting support can provide the opportunity for your brain to expand. Like I always think of the metaphor, and this applies to literally almost everything I think in mental health, of how do we change? It's not that the thing that's impacting us, whether it's grief, whether it's trauma, whether it's our anxiety, whether it's OCD, whether it's intrusive thoughts, whatever, it's not with time that that gets smaller or shrinks necessarily. It's really that our life gets bigger. And then that takes up less space in our life. And we have a lot more variety of other experiences and other things going on in our life that it feels less overwhelming. But the problem with that thing is it often not only is big, but it shrinks other things. We stop spending time with friends, with family, taking care of ourselves, sleeping, doing things that we love. So then that ball is our whole life. And it feels like, oh my God, I have nothing else. So that is how we like recover from almost anything mental health wise, is getting out in our life, taking care of ourselves and building new brain pathways so that your last referential experience, like I think about this a lot with when I'm talking to people about alcohol, like if you've never gone to a restaurant and not ordered an alcoholic beverage, it is going to be really scary. But as you practice it and do it, it becomes a lot less scary because you're exposed to it, you've done it. And now when you think about doing that, your brain has a referential experience to be like, oh, I actually can do that. And it's not that drinking, the urge goes away even necessarily, or that you just can write over that brain pathway. But based in the brain, what you're creating is a new neural pathway, like a new path, if you want to use that metaphor. So then you have more options when you're interacting with that trigger.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And the metaphor that I typically use is I talk about it like a road. Mm-hmm. So once you go through something really traumatic, really difficult, something that really has a lasting impact on you, chronic experience, if you will, your brain starts to operate as if it's on like a major interstate, right? And the interstate that's near your house. You could drive it with your eyes closed. You know where all the exits are. You know how everything looks. You know every bump to avoid. Your brain exists in this very predictable avenue.
It's so predictable that you don't even have to remember driving on it.
Right. Exactly. Your brain just goes there. And your brain's like, nope, we don't do this. We don't do that. We avoid this. We need to do that. Right. Like all of it is rooted in keeping you safe. And you are so on autopilot, you feel trapped on this road. And when I introduce to my clients that like, oof, we're going to have to push ourselves a little bit, it's essentially, I'm telling you to get off on not an exit. I'm asking you to be in an ATV that has 2.5 wheels and all you have to get through the brush is like a dull machete.
I
want to validate that that's yeah. how it feels. Like it feels like we're taking all of these predictable, comfortable tools away and telling you like, good luck. I find, and I've found this in my own life, there has been a tremendous amount of growth and powerful rebuilding in those moments when I decided to just like go out in the brush and like make it work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like that was where I've learned who I am as a person, mm-hmm. what matters to me, what I want to be in life, making sense of the experiences that I went through in a more like organic, authentic way. Mm-hmm. And so like, I know if you have been through things that you would classify as trauma, or maybe you have in the past been diagnosed like with PTSD, none of this episode is about like taking that from you. But I think it's like anything that we talk about, at some point, you have to be willing to let go of that traumatic thing being the only narrative. And I think that's what I wanted to kind of have as like almost the midpoint, I guess, mm-hmm. is something that is difficult, I think, with therapy speak. And I know this would probably be controversial mm-hmm. to some, but it just is. Mm-hmm. I do think there are some things that people are forced into believing it impacted yeah. them so negatively and so awful and their life has been destroyed by this thing, even if they may not relate to that on an internal level.
And that's the problem with trauma speak specifically, I think, compared to even ADHD or something like that, because you're going to get in front of a therapist. They're not going to tell you, rightly so, if you feel impacted, you were impacted.
Right. Yeah. No, no, like, sane therapist is going to be like, you're lying. Like, we don't do that.
Where if you say you have ADHD, we may be like, I don't know if you do.
Right. What I will challenge people on is the narrative that they have in their life about what the trauma says about them. But then two, also what it says they are and are not capable of. Because going back to the road metaphor, that well-worn road is going to have a very specific list of things that you think you can and cannot do. And that road isn't always the most accurate predictor because your brain was so rocked by what you went through that it is now on DEFCON 5 in keeping you safe. And the safety that our brain convinces us we need isn't always the exact safety that we need.
Correct.
I think what is so often missing, like among a million other things in the therapy speak and the online internet therapy space, is nobody is really pushing anybody to do anything different. Most of the content is designed to just tell you why something was traumatic, why something was awful, why something would have ruined you, and then it stops there. That is an excellent point to make. And I think there's a lot of people that need to be validated in the horrible things that they've went through that, like, yes, that was categorically awful. And any sane person would be impacted by going through that. And I think some people feel then trapped that they're stuck in this reality where it's just they went through this horrible thing and it's ruined their life. And that now has to be the dictating driving factor behind everything that they do.
And it is true, like we were talking about, with how much space it takes up. When you overly focus on something, your brain starts to notice it. It is like the example of if you're looking for a new car and you never see that car on the road, you think, oh my God, this is so unique. I'm going to get the coolest, newest car. And then you start driving around after looking at this car and you're going to start seeing that car everywhere. It is not that there are more of that car that just showed up in the road. It is that your brain started focusing on it. That doesn't mean you manifested it. That doesn't mean that it's your fault or anything like that. We're not saying you can control how it impacts you totally or anything like that. Right. But it is what we were saying with this new road, this new path. When you're stuck on that highway, when you're stuck and then you're told about how horrible this is, it is hard to imagine a different way of living. And your brain can get stuck there. And I feel this way a lot about even my chronic pain. I got very stuck in my chronic pain and it made me extremely hypervigilant. I think that was connected to my birth trauma because for those that don't know, I went into liver failure when I was pregnant and I was told by a bunch of doctors that I was crazy and that that wasn't happening. And then it escalated extremely quickly. And I left that experience being like, I don't trust myself. I don't trust my body. I don't trust myself to advocate. And I've since been super, super hyper vigilant about thinking about my body and trauma and, you know, the physical impacts. And it made me so that I was focusing so much on what was going on. I wasn't moving freely. I was terrified of movement. Any little sensation would make me crazy. And it made me very afraid of my body and sensation. I still have chronic pain. I'm still working through it. But I've been doing something called pain reprocessing therapy, which is sort of like this for just pain that kind of teaches your brain that if you stop being afraid of the pain and you start allowing yourself to sit with it and practice mindfulness and trust yourself and not kind of overcorrect as a response of pain, like I would just not do anything because I was so afraid. I think this is a very good metaphor mentally too. It's like if you feel pain and you completely stop moving, that also causes problems because your body is designed to move and it needs movement. Just like your mental health, if you stop doing anything that slightly increases your heart rate or makes you a teeny bit afraid, that will then cause more problems than you originally had.
There's like 50 different things that I want to say in response to that. And so in my brain, I'm like trying to weed through it. But one, to go back to the start, when you're telling the story about your doctor, that is exactly why therapists don't say, oh no, that wasn't traumatic. Because that right there added to your traumatic birth story that you were dismissed and belittled in bringing these concerns up, which then amplified the trauma on the other side of it. So that is why we always ask questions and we believe people with what they're saying. And we don't try to tell people what it is or isn't that they didn't experience. Mm-hmm. And even in this episode, again, that's not what we're doing. We're not sitting here telling you, well, this has to hit this criteria to be this or this has to be that. No, it's exactly as Amanda's talking about. What we want to introduce is that accepting it is the first part. Accepting that you went through something really difficult and challenging and heartbreaking and traumatic is only half of the equation. The other half of the equation is learning how to deal with the pain, which is exactly the therapy that you are going through. And I think because of the lot of the therapy speak and this missing middle point, a lot of people are like, how dare you ask me to sit in the space with this thing that broke me? And understandably, that viewpoint creates a lot of tension and defensiveness in people when we start saying like, nah, you got to go there. Because I'm not asking you to sit in the room with the event. Mm-hmm. I'm not asking you to go back to the immediate moment or describe in detail. Sometimes certain types of therapy that might work. There is narrative therapy. EMDR deals with highlighting the situation of what happened. But what I am asking you to sit with is the pain that you have in this moment. Because the pain that you experience on a day-to-day basis, whether it's tied to a traumatic event or whether it's just existing in the world, that pain changes and undulates depending on your mood, how you're doing, what's going on, the support you have in your life, the things that you have to look forward to, what you feel is going on around you, all of that contributes. And what I want you to work on is sitting with the discomfort rather than immediately leaning in to that well-worn road coping skill of avoidance. Mm-hmm. Whatever that avoidance looks like for you, right? And like for Amanda, for you, it was not moving.
Yeah.
It was choosing to just paralyze yourself and your life to avoid having to experience it. And sometimes you have to be that way for a minute. And I'm going to validate that too. Like sometimes you do have to hit pause on some things and be like, mm-hmm. I need to like shelter in place, mm-hmm. take some deep breaths and get my bearings. Absolutely. I've had to do that in my life at different points. Mm-hmm. And at some point, if you want life to change, if you are feeling stagnant, if you are feeling stuck, if you're feeling overwhelmed, at some point you are going to have to move again in that space where you live with the pain that you're feeling. There is going to be a moment where you are going to have to reconcile and figure out how to wrap your arms around it, mm-hmm. in order to live a life that actually feels authentic for you. I think for people that are new in the journey, that's kind of a spicy take because again, even like in therapy, my therapy clients are sometimes like, well, why are we going back there? Why are you asking me to sit in that? Don't I want to move forward? Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, notice how every time you try to move forward without acknowledging it,
right,
you spin in place because you're not doing anything different. You're trying to talk yourself out of either like, because if you have shame of what you went through, you're trying to talk mm-hmm. yourself out of like, well, that wasn't a big deal and that didn't matter. And well, that person wasn't affected by that. So that means I shouldn't have been affected by it. And it's like, well, you were affected by it. Let's meet ourselves where we're at and see what we can do.
And also, I think a lot of us are so afraid of our emotions.
Yes.
Don't know how to process our emotions. No. Spend so much time judging, shaming, critiquing, avoiding our emotions. Mm-hmm. When we think we're processing them, when none of those things are actually processing your emotions, that people feel like, well, I've already been doing this. And once you dig in, you're like, no, you've just been beating yourself up about feeling depressed. Or you've been ignoring the fact that you have flashbacks and what pain comes up.
Right.
So go listen to the how to process your emotions if you're like, I don't know how to do that episode. Yeah.
That's a 5 out of 5 episode. I think there's a big word that gets thrown around online mm-hmm. that I think mm-hmm. I've seen attached to trauma a lot, which is intellectualizing. Mm-hmm. There's a caveat that I want to add to that because I think, again, there's people that think they're processing, but they're intellectualizing. But I think there's mm-hmm. people that think they are intellectualizing when actually they are processing. You do have to think about what happened to you. Mm-hmm. To think about something is not intellectualizing it.
Correct.
To sit in discussing something or walking through the narrative or being like, God, that was just like so fucking awful. That was so horrible. That's not intellectualizing. Mm-hmm. That is the verbal processing piece that often needs to accompany the somatic feeling piece. Those two things need to go hand in hand. When I am telling you to feel something, I'm not telling you to just be like, we're sad. That sucks. Like, oh, why? What did that feeling evoke in you? What did that thought evoke in you? That's what we're talking about processing. Intellectualizing is when you spend so much time doing one of two things, or both often. You either spin yourself in circle just saying, I shouldn't be feeling sad. Why am I feeling sad? I shouldn't be feeling sad. It's been long enough that I feel sad. I really shouldn't feel sad anymore. Why am I angry? You know, like it's been so much time. I just don't understand why I'm angry. You're either doing that and or you're running through like, well, you know, I did feel that at one point, but I don't now because of this. I think looking back, it really wasn't that big of a deal. I think plenty of people have been through this. People have it way worse than I do. That is intellectualizing.
And then there's rumination. Rumination is a type of mental compulsion where you are also spinning your wheels and stuck. And it is a response to a worry or an intrusive thought. So it is not always just a response to like you feel sad, although you can ruminate about being sad. But there is a big difference between ruminating, processing, and problem solving. So rumination often is, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? And you go down this like thought spiral of every single worry you can possibly think of that attaches to this main worry. You also may like mentally review what happened over and over and over again, looking for signs that if you had done something different or something else had happened or they said something differently, it would have been different. That is a mental compulsion as well. And it is scratching the itch instead of the real healing is learning to sit with the itch without scratching, processing how you feel while the itch makes you want to go insane, and then naturally waiting for the itch to die down and then having faith in yourself that you will be able to do it better next time. Okay, if you are hearing Sam and I talk about trauma and you're feeling a little bit like, oh, I could use a little bit more support than this, but I don't know what kind of therapist I need, what trauma work I should get into, I would love to share with you my Practice Therapy for Women Center. We are trauma specialists. Over half of our team does EMDR. We do somatic therapy. But all of our therapists are trauma informed and trauma trained. And it's a huge part of what we do. And we would love to help you. We are based in the Philly area. We have 4 office locations there, but we also have licensed therapists in 42 states across the country. So if you've been searching for a trauma therapist and haven't found the right fit, I would love you to check out our website, therapyforwomencenter.com.
This is why when we said at the start this was going to be big, because it is so layered and there are so many different offshoots that you can run into that you don't even realize that due to like the overabundance of therapy speak and the lack of nuance, you now assume that all of those things are the same thing. When in fact they are separate processes. And the other interesting layer in terms of like, if we're going to maybe focus in on the differences of like the rumination and the processing and the problem solving and the intellectualizing and all of that, the reason why it's so important to get into the weeds and to start peeling back these layers is because two people could experience the same thing at the same exact moment in the same circumstances, and will walk away with different meaning, different experience, different emotional response, and a different level of trauma. I'll give you an example. My sister and I, growing up with my brother, we grew up in the same house with the same parents, with the same brother, with the same access to opportunity, the same type of support, all of it. And we are each impacted differently. By that. There were things that were really difficult for me that maybe didn't impact her as much. And it's the same in the reverse. Every single person processes things, even like good neutral events, every single person processes differently. And it is okay if in response to something traumatic, maybe you didn't have rumination. Maybe because of your life circumstances and things that you've done before, you were able to lean into the feeling of it and process it. And maybe you were able to come through that a little more quickly than someone else mm-hmm. who got trapped in intellectualizing or rumination or problem solving. Mm-hmm. This is why I know it seems like it's really complex and overwhelming, but actually it's this complexity that kind of gives you freedom mm-hmm. to be able to say like, oh, I get to decide what this was. Like I get to decide what my response is and how I want to do it differently and how I want to change it. And that simply because the person that you were with went through it one way, you don't have to own that.
Absolutely. And I think, Sam, the other hopeful part is that while all of these entry points might be different, mm-hmm. the solution to all of them is the same. I remember when I first started working in addiction, I was very obsessed with only working with people with addiction because I was like, I understand them. I am an addict. Those are the only people that I get. And right. the longer I do this work, and I actually discovered this within like a year, we all are the same. We all have the capacity to be negatively impacted, yep. to do things that are hurting us, to end up with addictive habits, to end up with an addiction. We're all trying to escape our pain and feel better because that is just human evolution. Mm-hmm. And our brain doesn't care about you being happy. It just cares about you surviving. And all these things that we're talking about are like adaptive strategies your brain is coming up with to mm-hmm. survive the trauma. Mm-hmm. And the pain, because it's really hard to sit in pain. And none of us talk about how to sit in pain. And our world doesn't really appreciate pain. And we expect people to be happy. Yeah, I just want people to know that while this may sound overwhelming, don't get caught up in the nuances we're explaining them. But the solution to all of them is to learn how to stop scratching the itch, mm-hmm. to learn how to be present, mm-hmm. to slowly learn how to deal with what happened to you through whatever way works for you, and mm-hmm. to start taking different action that will more align you with your goals and the life that you want to live.
I got like a front row seat to all of this for 5.5 years when I worked at a level one trauma emergency room. Obviously, I was seeing people in it doesn't get much worse. And if your family member is in there, you're really not doing well. A fascinating experience now being 2 years removed from it, because it was wild to watch people go through this insane trauma while then it's not my grief. Mm-hmm. But then I would have these moments where I would be like, I know I'm being like secondarily impacted by this, mm-hmm. but I didn't always know how.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Sam, that is – I mean, you have such a clear, direct story about how much secondary trauma can impact you, and I know that you have a lot more than you can share. Before we get into it, I wanted to bring up one of the things that's bothered me a lot recently is the posts, your nervous system cannot tell the difference between trauma happening on the internet – and the trauma that you experience, and that little bit of therapy yep. speak, it feels almost yep. very similar to your brain can hear every thought that you think. So don't think negative thoughts energy, which I also don't like. But yeah, so I did research on it to be sure that I was correct. I think what's so interesting is, right, so vicarious trauma is exposure to other people's trauma through media, videos, or images. And studies show about 20% of people watching graphic media can score high on trauma measures. And your brain creates this stress response in the moment. But the really big difference is it doesn't cause the same lasting structural brain changes as different trauma. So I think I want to say this because I'm not even saying that you're not being traumatized by being exposed to all of the horrific things, unfortunately, this year, but also last year. I mean,
the last 5 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. The amount of, with TikTok, I think especially, people can watch live streamed war and yeah. horror that's happening in real life on right. a totally different level. Mm-hmm. And it's really an interesting concept to get into of when we didn't have social media, and the democratization of this has also created this weird thing where, you know, the media used to say, we're not going to show graphic content, or we're going to say a warning. And when we talked about the amount of people that watched Charlie Kirk die, and I yeah. knew that that was a possibility. I know you saw it without yep. even
nope.
wanting to see it.
Right.
And I purposely, after you told me that you did not go on TikTok
yep.
for a week, because I was like, I don't trust
yeah.
that this is not going to be fed to me. So it's not that it doesn't impact us, but it is different. It is also interesting. I found a study where people said that vicarious trauma does have some brain changes, but they are different. Direct and secondary are much more similar. You can develop PTSD as a result of secondary, for sure. Vicarious is a little bit different. And I wanted to say that too, because I think also a lot of people are freaking out on the internet. I've seen a lot of people being like, I've been traumatized 24/7 since COVID.
Yeah. And that's, I don't want to say not possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with not likely.
Yeah.
Like if someone is saying that, that is kind of satirical, hyperbolic yeah. speech, which yeah. I think this intense satire and hyperbole mm-hmm. has really taken off with the internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, just, you know, yes. I'm dead or cooked.
Yes.
That has contributed to the feeling of like, even if someone sharing that doesn't actually themselves think.
Yeah.
Right. It's just the way they're describing how their experience mm-hmm. has been the past 5-6 years. There are people that see that and go, oh my God, yeah, I have been traumatized by this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm traumatized. I can't function because I might see these things, or I've seen mm-hmm. these things. And it's a really hard reminder that like, you're not experiencing those things, though. Mm-hmm. You're seeing them, which evokes emotion in you because you're a mm-hmm. normal human being, a typical human being that doesn't want to know that people are suffering or being caused harm or going through horrible things. And there's a spectrum to things that humans endure that when we find out about, we have a spectrum of emotional reactions to. And yet, when you still like live your life and that isn't in your direct vicinity, this thing that you're seeing, right? It's okay to say, I was shaken up by something. Mm-hmm. This bothered me. This upset me. But to be cautious with the language of, I'm traumatized.
Mm-hmm. And vicarious trauma can happen. And I think some people are traumatized from seeing all of this. That doesn't mean they have PTSD
right.
or that it will create life-altering brain changes.
Correct.
And I think that's the nuance of it.
It might change your beliefs on things.
I read a really interesting research article about how the structural changes to your brain don't happen in vicarious trauma, but what does happen is your beliefs change and your view of the world often changes through vicarious trauma, which I think is really a fascinating component of, we've talked a lot about polarization and what it does to our mental health. And I think it's a really fascinating way to look at, has this also caused way more polarization because we see these things now, we're getting desensitized to certain things because of some of this vicarious trauma. How is it changing our belief system? How do people look at the same thing and come up with totally different beliefs because of their previous beliefs? It's just a whole rabbit hole that sort of blew my mind. And then the other really fascinating thing, Sam, is as I was thinking about it, I think that what's also been happening the past 5 years
mm-hmm.
with all of us being increasingly online, with mm-hmm. all of us having more parasocial relationships with people that we
mm-hmm.
like don't actually know, with COVID changing communities and people are much more online across the board, they've found that every generation is spending way less time with people in person.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't having people over. It's a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
What is the line between secondary trauma and vicarious trauma that are starting to blur. And I think that's a really interesting component of when someone is your favorite podcaster or someone you really like on TV or whatever, you follow them online, you watch them, you know their family, you keep up with things, and they die. That is where the lines start to bleed, and we don't even have research on that, but it's starting to collapse them a little bit, I think.
Do you know who I'm like, I don't know if we'll survive this loss? Taylor Swift. I'm fascinated, hopefully 100 years from now, when she dies.
Oh, when Taylor Swift dies?
Yeah, like that parasocial relationship. And I just think of how attached people feel to celebrities now, because like, even if you look back at like, let's say, like the golden age of Hollywood, right? If we go all the way from like silent film to like the age of social media, there was such a remoteness to celebrities. Yeah. We saw them in very specific settings, very curated events.
It was shocking when they joined Instagram.
Yes. And when all of a sudden we could see that like, wow, they like cut potatoes the same way I do when they're cooking, or that they just post their life, or they post what they're doing, or they talk more openly to us and they're interacting with us. I think it absolutely created this sense that like, no, I know these people. I know them. I understand them.
I know their inside jokes. So I am their friend.
And I think that blurring of the social line has created like a depth of knowing that when someone dies or something horrible happens, you truly feel like you are experiencing a loss. And not just a loss because of the artistry or what they created or what they made. It's like you're losing a person who was influential in your life.
Yes, it's a really good point.
And there is like a very serious depth there that you, I wouldn't know of any data on understanding that, because I think that is such like a recent phenomenon, especially with like, even to take it a step further, like influencers. And it creates this odd, exactly as you said, like we're blurring this line of like the secondary and the vicarious. And it's like, well, technically we're still in the vicarious, but have we molded into secondary with this now because of like the perceived intimacy that we have with some of these figures and in this online world, in this online space, or even people you've never met before, like people that you've met virtually that like you've never met, but you have this connection. You talk all the time. You've never done anything together. You've never even like hugged them, right? But you have that connection there. And so it's like if something happens and they, you know, It's a very fascinating question for like how this is impacting our relationship and understanding to trauma and what is trauma. And if you're up for it, I feel like this would be a good time for me to kind of dive into what the hospital experience was for me, because I cannot think of a personal experience that I've had that was more clear cut of like sorting through this understanding of secondary trauma and what it is and what it isn't. And was I traumatized by something versus just emotionally impacted? Yeah, there's a lot that I could go into about that.
Yeah, let's go for it.
So I have to be very cautious with this. Because my radar is off sometimes of what people are prepared to hear. I try really hard to be honest about the experience, because I think this is part of the problem, is we can feel that the things that we've been through are too much for others to carry. And I think it's important to find ways to put words to what you've been through. And so with that said, I think that the biggest thing that jumps out to me when I think of my experience in the hospital is not even just specific stories. Some do. Some will stick with me forever. And it's not even who I worked with. We had fun times. Things were good. There's just kind of the general rollout of what my job was and what that looked like when I was dealing with those adrenaline rush cases that were legitimately life or death. Sitting in that space, there was always like a before. Like when you would get the page that the trauma or the full arrest was coming in and you had very basic information, you knew the age, you knew the gender, you knew the mechanism, which is like essentially what happened, like the injuries, mm-hmm. just kind of this general description. There was this moment where like you knew you were about to see something just awful, but you never knew exactly how it was going to turn out because there were always things that you would hear about it sight unseen and be like, oh my God, that's going to be horrific. And then it actually ended up not being as bad. Or there were things that you had seen and be like, well, that's pretty like run of the mill. And then it ends up devolving into a nightmare. I felt like I was just always sitting in these spaces of preparing for the worst. And there were just some things that would happen. There were some situations that you knew were just going to be awful, even if you didn't know the how, even if you didn't know what exactly your role was going to be or how the family was going to be. You just were like, this is just going to be so shitty. And the thing about deaths was they ate up so much of your day. And so it was like, not only am I a part of like helping these families, but like I'm seeing this like constantly. I'm seeing it all mm-hmm. the time. I think there were some situations with families that felt particularly emotionally raw for me. If we're going to say the patient is now out of the equation mm-hmm. because they are no longer on this mortal plane. So an individual finding out that their family member has died
yep.
is a traumatic event.
Yep.
If the patient had survived
yeah.
and was more likely than not going to be able to survive enough to the point that they're discharged from the hospital, we don't know the state that they're going to be in and the type of care that they're going to need. But if they are going to be discharged, the patient is now the direct recipient of the trauma. Mm-hmm. The family is secondary. Mm-hmm. And if we go back to the death, in that moment, I was secondary
yes.
to that trauma because I was witnessing it. Mm-hmm. Same thing as the family. If the patient survives, but they are now disabled or they have a chronic condition or they are going to need long-term care, the family is now mm-hmm. secondary to that because their lives have been impacted by the emotion of all of that. I knew I would, when I would see these things or you hear about these horrible stories in the ER, you get treated like shit by like patients. I would intellectualize it by saying, well, it's not my grief. And so that makes it okay. Mm-hmm. And while factually that is true, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't my grief. However, I carried all of that with me. I would start to notice as time went on, I was becoming really resentful of the people who needed me to do the work. And I felt like such a dick because I'm like, this is not their fault. And I just thought I was being like mega bitch mm-hmm. or that I was lazy or that mm-hmm. I wasn't as good as like my other colleagues mm-hmm. in managing it. And what I realized was by the time I got to that space, I had spent so many years talking myself out of why my jobs didn't bug me mm-hmm. that I had just minimized all of this secondary trauma that I was taking on. Mm-hmm. The thing that a lot of people don't talk about is like after time of death is called, the medical team just kind of like they disappear. Mm-hmm. They don't want to deal with any of that. My team was so wonderful and so supportive. And that's what helped, I think, mm-hmm. kind of like pull me along was I had such incredible coworkers that I could rely on and depend on. But then it just happens again and again and again and again. And then the next time, you know, often, if a patient arrived via ambulance before family got there, there were times where, depending on what was going on, the patient would die mm-hmm. before family got there. Mm-hmm. So when family comes in the lobby, the front desk people call me and say, family's here. And the doctor's like, oh, will you go get them and I'll meet you in the room? So I know when I go get them, I can't tell them what I know right. yet. And there was quite a long walk, and I would know that whole time mm-hmm. that I'm like walking this family to their doom.
Yeah.
And that was just like, I hated carrying that. and knowing what I was about to inflict on their life. Mm-hmm. Wasn't my fault. I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. But I knew, I remember there were a couple times, depending on like how tragic the situation was, I was like counting down in my head of like, this is the last moment of mm-hmm. the before. Like, this is it. This is the last moment of the before. And the second I bring you in that room, you're in the after. Mm-hmm. And that was like, I think what I realized for me was like, that was like a really holy space. Mm-hmm. And I hated how some of the doctors were at times. Mm-hmm. I hated how cold they were. I hated how inept they were at communicating any of this. Some were really good. Most were average at best. Mm-hmm. Others were horrendous. And it made my job so complicated. Mm-hmm. And I was resentful towards that. And I felt like I was being asked to do all of this work. And, you know, there were times where the nurses would be like, oh my God, I'm going to be there. And then they would like evaporate. Mm-hmm. Or they would ask us to go in and just like hear the most heinous, horrible stories from people because the nurse didn't want to have to hear it. Mm-hmm. Even though there was like nothing clinically I could do, there was nothing I was offering them. They'd just be like, they're really sad. Will you go talk to them? Mm-hmm. And so sure, like in that moment, I guess, yeah, there's a world where it's like, okay, as the clinical social worker, like, yeah, that's my job to like talk to people and hold space. But to be hearing and seeing the worst things that could happen to someone every single day, all day, every
right
day.
We haven't even talked about how agency makes a huge, huge difference in something being traumatic mm-hmm. or not, and the feeling specifically of agency, of being able to escape, of being able to fight yep. back, of being able to make a difference really is predictive and correlated with whether something is traumatic or not. And what I thought of as you were sharing that, Sam, was you had no agency because you weren't nope. a doctor or a nurse who was nope. at least had memories of like patients getting better, you know, or yeah. you didn't have any yeah. power in actually, I mean, no. besides when someone is, you know, going to go to rehab or you're keeping them for a suicidal yeah. assessment or whatever, you don't have a lot of direct agency in feeling like you're making mm-mm. a difference either.
No, not at all. And that was the hardest part, is I felt trapped.
Yeah.
And smack dab in the middle of working there is when COVID hit, and I worked all through the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it was in that same process that I realized I had a tremendous amount of regrets for picking the career that I chose. And so not only did I feel trapped in this job, I felt trapped in the career. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And it was really overwhelming. And the thing that I hated was I was actually like really good at it. And I was so resentful of the fact that I was good at it. And I was really resentful towards a lot of the doctors. Mm-hmm. And a lot of doctors put me in like really uncomfortable positions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a physician one time, we had this horrific, horrific case where a woman and her daughter were involved in a car accident and the woman died. And nobody else wanted to tell the kid. It was kind of like hot potato. Mm-hmm. And so first responders just brought her to the emergency room because they didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And so her family was showing up and there were multiple physicians involved. And typically the physician that we would choose to speak with the families mm-hmm. was the one who had managed the patient mm-hmm. from the time they arrived to the time they called time of death mm-hmm. because that was the physician that could walk the family through exactly what was done, what had happened, why they did what they mm-hmm. did. I went and grabbed that doctor because there were two separate doctors working. We go in with the family. We tell the kid, it's one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. Absolutely horrible, devastating. Thank God her family was as supportive as they were. And I went out to tell the other physician and he got mad at me mm-hmm. that I didn't involve him. Said that I stole his patient from him, screamed at me in front of probably 15 other physicians mm-hmm. who all saw that happen, and he threw a chair at me. He had a roller chair, and he rolled it right at me where I was like standing next to the desk, and it slammed into the desk. And I was so angry and nothing came of it and nothing happened. And I was like, here I am going through like the most traumatic event of my life and you're making this my problem. Mm-hmm. And so it's those types of situations, like if you're talking about exposure to something chronic, mm-hmm. right? This job was a chronic situation mm-hmm. that I was really negatively impacted by. It's all of those little elements around it. Is that exactly as you said, like if you feel trapped, if you don't feel like you have support, mm-hmm. If you feel alone, if you feel like you're constantly doing something wrong or what you're doing isn't enough or you're not responding to it correctly, all of that complicates how you interpret the situation itself. And when on my days when I was off, I would try to just like avoid it mm-hmm. mentally. Like I would be like, I don't want to go there. I don't want to think about it. But the reason I tell this long saga is not to just say like, oh, I, you know, pity me or that I've figured it all out. I had to completely rewire my brain after I left that job. And I left that job in September of 2023. I have spent the last 2 years having to completely rebuild my relationship to my profession, mm-hmm. having to spend time sitting in the secondary pain that I experienced mm-hmm. from some of these situations. I have allowed myself to cry mm-hmm. over things. I've allowed myself to mourn. I stopped telling myself that I couldn't feel it just because it wasn't my grief. Mm-hmm. I had to allow myself room to experience it the way I experienced it mm-hmm. and to not search for excuses for why I shouldn't, or to look at how my coworkers were dealing with it and saying like, well, why do they seem to be managing it so much better than me? Like, what's wrong with me? Well, that doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. They are dealing with it in their own way. Mm-hmm. I had a hard time dealing with it. I hope that in some way like this resonates with someone to say like, whatever you've been through in your life, you get to meet yourself exactly where you're at with it. And you get to decide what that experience meant to you. You can take as long as you need to recover from it. I'm going on 2 years and it's been a steady climb. It's been a steady climb out of it. But I am very aware of it now. And one of the surgeons towards the end while I was working there, he was really, really a great guy. And so one time, me and the surgeon were speaking and he asked me, he's like, how do you do it? And he goes, I'm a plumber. Mm-hmm. He goes, my job is very straightforward. He goes, when I get someone in surgery, my job is very simple. I have to try to put the pieces back together. And he said, I don't know how you do what you do. And I was kind of in this moment where I was starting to be more honest about it. And I said, I don't know. He goes, I heard a story when I was in medical school that every surgeon carries a graveyard in their heart. And he said, it's all the losses mm-hmm. that they've experienced. And that really struck me. And I realized I'm meant to have a graveyard in my chest mm-hmm. because I've been a part of all of these stories and all of these experiences. And I've witnessed this insane level of pain. Mm-hmm. And I've witnessed like tragedy and trauma. And I accepted that it's okay that that affected me. It wasn't my job to not be affected by it. And I think sometimes we can feel a tremendous amount of shame when we do experience things of we run through the list of like why it shouldn't have impacted you. That shouldn't have been a big deal. That shouldn't have mattered. I should have, right? Well, it did. And it's okay if you have a little graveyard in your heart, whether that's for other people, whether that's for the version of you that experienced that or the versions of you that you've had to go through to heal from those things. That little graveyard in my chest is a very sacred place and I allow it to exist. And I can go visit it, but I don't have to stay there anymore. And I can get out and I can live my life and I can nurture myself and take care of myself, but it's there.
Well, that metaphor is very powerful. It's very sad. And as someone who's yeah. only had one direct death as a result of that I know of close to me when yeah. I was working at a rehab, there were other people that died, but I wasn't directly involved in that case. I can't imagine how much it wears on you because I think about that one client that I had that died all the time. So yeah, I know this was like an intense episode, but trauma is an intense topic mm-hmm. and it's wide ranging. And hopefully you all got something out of us talking about all of the different facets of it. There will also be a follow-up on Substack to this where we will, you know, a lot of these metaphors are like windy and complex as we talk about them, but we will make them into a more visual component and organize it so that it's a bit of a guide for you to understand trauma differently.
Yeah. And I think the heaviness is part of why we like debated talking about it, because it's hard and everybody has a different connection to it. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody has a different threshold for what they can and can't hear. And mine is absurd. But, you know, I think this is why we do the guides on Substack, is so that you guys can have a frame of reference to kind of go read through, because sometimes reading feels a little less aggressive than listening. So that's why we created the Substack, really, is to kind of have this additional place with additional resources that you can go back to, where we really like lay things out in a more visual format.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can I end with one quote?
Yeah, please.
This is from No BS Therapist, Jacqueline Tanaglia. She says, she uses the word pain, but I think we can swap the word trauma in here. She says, there's no hierarchy to trauma. Trauma isn't a contest. At the same time, a paper cut is not an amputation. But paper cuts can feel like amputations, in which case they warrant attentions. And yet, people undergoing amputations probably need more support than those suffering from paper cuts.
That is spot on.
We rest our case.
Yeah, that's all. That's it. You can, phone it in, because that's neither one of those experiences were minimized, yet the ones needing the most attention were prioritized. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to apply that in your own life.
Mm-hmm. There's a saying in rehab, you have to work on what's killing you first. So if people come in addicted to heroin and have relationship problems, we got to work on the heroin first. All right, everybody. We appreciate you listening so much. As always, we appreciate all your support.
If you could rate, review, share, subscribe. We are working on getting the word out about the pod and very excited about the growth that we've had. And we owe all of that to you. And so anything that you can do to keep helping us spread the word, and if you want to send this episode to someone, if you feel like it'll resonate, if you could share about it, let us know, you know, what you liked about us, tag us in your stories. And means the world.
We'll see you next week.
Okay, bye.